Well, good evening. It's good to be doing the series together and Ezekiel with you. And I've really enjoyed last week. I pray you did as well if you were here. If not, I apologize in advance, or in a week later, sorry. So we're continuing in Ezekiel. We're going to go to Ezekiel 8 today. Last week we looked at Ezekiel 1, 22 to the end of chapter 2. We looked at this experience that Ezekiel had of God's calling on his life. And essentially, I gave you a bit of the background before about the captivity that was going on. So 2 Kings 24:14 talks about how 10,000 of the Israelites have been taken away to Babylon and taken into captivity there. And basically they put in with the Egyptians and they went to war and they refused to pay a tribute to Nebuchadnezzar. And in the end, Nebuchadnezzar came along and taught them a lesson by taking them away. And essentially, this question arises within the people of Israel, those in captivity. They begin to ask the question, has God abandoned us? Why is it that we're in this position now where we're not in our homeland that God promised to us? Why is it that God doesn't seem to be coming through on his promise when he said, I'll be your God and you'll be my people? And the whole book of Ezekiel, and it's a hard book, is a lesson about God saying, I haven't abandoned you, you've abandoned me. And in this whole process, God calls both personally and as a nation, he calls the people back to him and says, but I'm still your God. Come to me. And so this whole aspect we'll be looking at today is termed up in one phrase of idolatry. So let's read together Ezekiel chapter 8, beginning at verse 1. In the sixth year, in the sixth month, on the fifth day, while I was sitting in my house and the elders of Judah were sitting before me, the hand of the sovereign Lord came upon me there. I looked and I saw a figure like that of a man from what appeared to be his waist down. He was like fire. And from there up, his appearance was as bright as glowing metal. He stretched out what looked like a hand and took me by the hair of my head. The Spirit lifted me up between earth and heaven, and in visions of God, he took me to Jerusalem, to the entrance, to the north gate of the inner court, where the idol that provokes to jealousy stood. And there before me was the glory of the God of Israel, as in the vision I had seen in the plain. Then he said to me, Son of man, look towards north. So I looked, and in the entrance north of the gate of the altar, I saw the idol of jealousy. And he said to me, Son of man, do you see what they are doing? The utterly detestable things the house of Israel is doing here. Things that will drive me far from my sanctuary. But you'll see things that are even more detestable. Then he brought me to the entrance of the court. I looked and I saw a hole in the wall. He said to me, Son of man, now dig into the wall. So I dug into the wall and saw a doorway there. And he said to me, go in and see the wicked and detestable things that they're doing here. So I went in and I looked and I saw portrayed all over the walls all kinds of crawling things and detestable animals and all the idols of the house of Israel. In front of them stood 70 elders of the house of Israel. And Jezanah, son of Zaphon, was standing among them. Each had a censer in his hand, and a fragrant cloud of incense was rising. He said to me, Son of man, have you seen what the elders of the house of Israel are doing in the darkness, each at the shrine of his own idol? They say, the Lord does not see us. The Lord has forsaken the land. Again, he said, you will see them doing things that are even more detestable. Then he brought me to the entrance to the north gate of the house of the Lord, and I saw a woman sitting there mourning for Tammuz. He said to me, "Do you see this, Son of Man? You'll see things that are even more detestable than this." He then brought me into the inner court of the house of the Lord, and there at the entrance to the temple, between the portico and the altar, were about 25 men, with their backs towards the temple of the Lord, and their faces towards the east. They were bowing down to the sun in the east. He said to me, "Have you seen this, Son of Man? Is it a trivial matter for the house of Judah to do the detestable things they are doing here? Must they also fill the land with violence and continually provoke me to anger? Look at them putting the branch to their nose. Therefore, I will deal with them in anger. I will not look on them with pity or spare them. Although they shout in my ears, I will not listen to them." Amen. This is God's word to us. Now, it seems about 14 months have passed between this time and the passage we saw in Ezekiel 1. Those in exile, so there's kind of a group of people who are left in Jerusalem. There's a group of people who are taken and kind of resettled, including Ezekiel. And then there's a group of people taken right into the royal house, which includes Daniel. So if you read the book of Daniel, you'll see that he's also taken away and put into this royal court and has a different experience in Babylon that Ezekiel has. And the elders are beginning to come and they're sitting at his feet, and it tells you that Ezekiel is being recognized as a voice of authority, as a prophet. And they're beginning to say to him, really, when are we going back? Surely it's soon. Surely it's not long now before we return. And Ezekiel, throughout the book, shares that it's not going to be right now, but there is a kind of come a time when the people of God will get to return back to Israel, as he promises them and as they would expect. There is this whole dilemma that they expected God to keep them safe. They expected God to give them his blessing and to make all other nations realize that Yahweh, the God of the Bible, is not just another God, but the only God. And of course, that is coming into question a little bit, because these other gods, Babylonian and so on, are more powerful, it would appear, than Yahweh in this. And so our text opens up in a very similar way to our text last week in Ezekiel 1 and 2. This time, the elders are present, and we recognize that Ezekiel is beginning to speak very knowingly of what's going on in Jerusalem. So as these elders sit, they're amazed at continually throughout the book of Ezekiel, the things that he predicts that are going on in the place of Jerusalem. He's even able to name names in that way that he does. And so then the hand of the sovereign Lord comes upon Ezekiel. And once that happens, Ezekiel reverts right back to this language of "it was like" that we saw last week. He says, "I saw what looked like a figure of a man. From what appeared to be his waist down, he was like fire, and from up his appearance was as bright as glowing metal." As we said last week, this isn't Ezekiel being vague about what he's seeing. In fact, he's trying to do justice to the glory of the picture that he sees when he has a presence of God with him. He wants to describe what he sees to others. He wants to have it recorded so that it can be tested, and that when you meet God, it's not like anything else. It's no comparison to an experience with God. And so Ezekiel has to say that it's bright like glowing metal. He seemed like a man. And so since he seemed like a man, what would typically be the waist divided his top half and his bottom. Above was like glowing metal. You get this picture of radiance, of glory powerfully shining through. And below is like consuming fire. It's like fire, a very dangerous thing, a very powerful thing to us. Something that isn't being fueled, but it just by its presence, it's giving off flames. A wonderful picture of just God's awesome power and presence. And so Ezekiel is just trying to do his best to do justice to this experience that he's having. Then, probably not Ezekiel's choice, he's taken, it's described, by the hair of his head. I do not recommend this as a mode of transport for anyone, but he's taken by the hair of his head. Now, we don't exactly know what is happening here, if this is a kind of trance where God is speaking to him in a vision, or if Ezekiel is actually being transported. I would imagine, since at one point he kind of digs out the wall, that this is more of a vision than an actual transportation. But the fact is that it could be either. Whatever it is, it's not normal. Whatever it is, it's just as likely that God is the one doing it, and it's not any other experience explainable except by God. There's kind of two examples in the book of Acts. One is where Peter has this vision. He calls it a trance, but I don't read into that in a modern sense. But he has this vision from God, which tells him that now, not just the Jews, but the gospel is also for the Gentiles. It's for everybody. And in that sense, he's clearly having a vision and describes it that way. But at the same time, Philip the evangelist, after meeting the Ethiopian eunuch, is transported by the Spirit to the next place where he's going. And so even the book of Acts alone, the work of the Spirit shows that either one of these would be a reasonable option. Doesn't really matter. Doesn't really change our passage. The important thing is what Ezekiel is describing to us. What does matter is Ezekiel is taken into the heart of the temple, into the inner court. It's an exclusive place. The temple functioned very much as a place that was exclusive to represent the holiness, the goodness, the awesomeness, the purity, the greatness of God was always represented in the temple. So you couldn't just walk around wherever you wanted to go when it came to the temple. The worship was based around a genuine fear in the right sense, which changed through Jesus Christ. Not because God became compromised in his holiness, but because he gave out his holiness. And so now we can approach God boldly. Hebrews has this wonderful description of coming into God's throne room boldly. It's not because God's going, "Ugh, I'll let it slide what I used to not let slide." But it's because through Christ we're made righteous. And so when God sees us, he just sees Christ's righteousness. He just sees Christ's goodness and says, "Come on into my presence. It's great to have you here." And so at the temple at this time, Christ hadn't yet died. And so there was still this sense of being very careful when you come into God's presence. So it means that Ezekiel is seeing what nobody else sees. This is a bit of inside information. It's a bit like if you've ever had a boss who would always kind of come out and tell you to work really hard, and then he would go into his office and thinking that you can see through the blinds, and he just sat in his office doing nothing, and you could always see it, you know, when you're going by, and you just think, what a hypocrite. And this is not a current boss. Don't worry, Alistair. I can see you read into that. Alistair and I don't work near each other, so I guarantee it's not him. Although that might tell you something. No, I'm kidding. So there's this aspect of a kind of hypocrisy going on when they come out, and when the doors are open, they're working hard, they're doing all the things, and then when the doors are closed, you know, suddenly it's a different game, it's a different story that's going on. You might have had some experiences maybe with, maybe your employment or maybe in your school or whatever, where you're asked to do things, you're told to do things, but really when the doors are closed, there's a different integrity, there's a different work ethic, there's a different story going on. And for the priests, it's how they behave when they weren't in the public view that tells you about who they are. And what Ezekiel sees is not encouraging. Now verse 10 tells us that Ezekiel saw portrayed all over the walls all kind of crawling things and detestable animals and all the idols of the house of Israel. In front of them stood 70 elders of the house of Israel, and Jazaniah, son of Zaphon, was standing among them. Ezekiel sees among the elders on who he recognizes, this guy, Jazaniah, and he names and shames him. Now, what's going on here is the very heart of the temple is those who are leaders of Israel are worshiping other gods and worshiping statues to those gods. And due to the mention of animals, etc., it's likely that the kind of form of Egyptian worship that we would often see in the hieroglyphics and things, if we see in the temples when we look into pyramids and this type of thing. So it doesn't surprise us, because Israel rebelled against Babylon, they rebelled with Israel. So there's a good close relationship at times between Egypt and Israel. So it wouldn't surprise us that there's a bit of worship gods have come over to Israel. Then Ezekiel leaves the temple and he sees some women worshipping Tammuz. So in the temple, the Egyptian worship shows that the leadership are worshipping God, but it's not just the leadership who are at fault. Here's some women who represent the general public, a more typical scene, and they're worshipping this false god, Tammuz, a god who's mourned for his death. And basically what happens at the end of the harvest, when the season's over, there's this theory that Tammuz dies, and so people would mourn him so that he would return in the season again. And so this kind of other worship, quite popular, found in most other religions, especially of the time. And I just want you to note that although this god dies and is reborn, this kind of idea is he dies in the cycle of the end of the harvest, then he's reborn when the harvest begins. This isn't the same as resurrection, okay, at all. So sometimes people take these stories of Tammuz, and I forget his name in the Greek type, and they say this is clearly a sign of Christianity already being spoken about. But resurrection is absolutely exclusive to Christianity. Christ doesn't die all the time. He only died once and he rose again. These gods would die in a continual cycle following the cycle of the harvest. So it's a completely different kind of cycle of life, death, and rebirth. Then Ezekiel's returned to the inner court and there is sun worship, this time with the point that the elders turned their back on the temple, which represents they've turned their back on God. Overall, it's clearly chaotic. There's many different gods creeping in, it seems, from every corner. And it's rampant. In fact, all of society are participating in it. Some of them still remain true to Yahweh. We see that a little later on if we had time to read on in Ezekiel. Now, the word used to describe the worship of something that's not God, the true worship, and to worship the true God who created all things, through whom nothing exists that he did not make. It's given this general term, idolatry. In a way, this can be a difficult word for us to use, and especially in these kind of contexts, because I don't think many of us are going home tonight to worship a statue or any of this type of stuff. And so I appreciate this kind of wording and language can sometimes be more kind of confusing than not. If you are going to, come speak to me at the end. I'd be like to have a chat with you about that. But nonetheless, even though it's a difficult term, idolatry is very much alive in our lives. And it's alive because we give other things a place which only God should have. Now, we have this same exclusive expectation on us as Israel. God said to Israel, I will be your God and you will be my people. He won't be one of your gods. He's exclusive. And for followers of Christ, we call him Lord. And this takes on this same exclusive meaning that Jesus is in charge of all of our lives. Paul actually described in his life that he used to be a slave to sin, to the things not of God. But now he was a slave to God. We might expect him to say that he was free, and he certainly was. But actually he describes himself as a slave to God. Everyone's a slave to something, and Paul doesn't lose this language because to Paul, we were bought at a price. Like a slave, it cost God to get us. And the good news is that he treats us like family, not slaves. But don't forget the cost Jesus Christ paid dying on the cross to buy you from death. I find idolatry one of the most difficult things to explain, and yet I also find so much of my life and so much of what I look within, idolatry is rampant in my own life. If I was to ask you the question, what's the most important thing in your life? Chances are that we would have lots of different answers that we give, and we could tally up and see what they are. But for some of us who kind of have the Sunday school answer, in Sunday school the lesson you learned was whatever the question was, the answer was Jesus. So if you wanted a free rubber or a free sharpener, however these kind of things you used to get, then your answer would be Jesus. And so they'd say to you, what's the most important thing in your life? And you would say, Jesus. And you would get a rubber out of that. See me at the end. Just kidding. But actually, if you were to give me answers, I would be amazed to sit down with you and then say, okay, let's try and unpack a little bit of your week and look and see if that adds up. And so I might kind of look at the questions of what do you do with your week? What kind of things do you spend your time in? And then we say, does that add up with what you think is the most important thing in your life? How do you spend your time, your resource? What makes you happy? What gives you this what makes you most look forward to doing. We need to look more at the way that we live, and we need to discover over what issues do we get angry. This is an interesting one. What things, when taken away from you, do you get really angry about? You get really furious about? What kind of things, when they don't go your way, do you get angry at God about? And these kind of things reveal what's important to us, what we feel is the most important thing in our lives. So I got a couple of examples for us. Could you imagine? Wow. That would have been awkward. Right. Until I die, doing an illustration. I can see why no one else does illustrations. They're too dangerous. Okay, so what we have here is a basic chart, basic being the key word. And I'll put it here. And so there's two words here in the chart. One is ultimate and one is meaningful, okay, which I recognize makes things more complicated. But this is as simple as I can get it going. And so there are things in our lives that give us meaning. There are good things in our lives. So if you were to describe who you were, I would describe myself as born in Aberdeen. It's a good thing, believe me. I would describe myself as the son of Alan and Nina, also a good thing. The brother of my brother Grant and Aaron. These are all things that are meaningful to me, but they don't mean everything to me. You know, I could cope with not having a brother. I won't say which one I could cope with more than the other, but I could cope with it. But they don't identify who I am. And the only thing that should take our identity, the only thing that should be a must in our lives, is God. So he's the ultimate. Everything's about him. Everything's in his way. And what happens with idolatry is we start to confuse these two realms. We begin to take things that are good and meaningful. We can take things that are bad as well, but we'll stick with good and meaningful things and begin to put them into the top half. And when that happens, we begin to see parts of our lives just begin to fall off of sync. So if we imagine a straight path, we would describe putting these things in the wrong place begins to squint us away from that straight path. So I've got three examples. This chair isn't going to hold it like I hoped it would, but that's all right. We'll get by. So for instance, one would be wealth. So we've been doing a series in the morning about wealth. We've been seeing that money in itself is not a bad thing. But what happens in our life when wealth becomes our ultimate, everything becomes about getting richer. And I really enjoy autobiographies. He's got a great one by a guy called Jack Welch. And he became the CEO of General Electric, which is like the biggest, I think, at one point at least, it was the biggest company in America. With something, I think Apple is now, but the biggest income or turnover or whatever it is. And as I was reading his book about how his life went from starting as a kind of working in plastics in the chemistry department of GE, he became the CEO and then took the company from, I think, 9 billion to kind of 40 billion or something like that. And there was just a line he almost dropped, and it said, to get to CEO, I always felt it was important that I would see my family in vacations, and holidays is the normal way of saying it. They've ruined it by calling it vacations for some reason, but they would go on vacations twice, 2 weeks in the year, because I would leave early in the morning and I would return late at night. Now, Jack Welch has made a great achievement in GE. But actually, I read that and I thought, I think that came at the wrong price. Success, wealth, whatever you want to call it, was so important to Jack Welch that he spent 2 weeks fully with his family going away to some other, went to some posh place or whatever they went to. And the rest of the time, he would leave really early in the morning and get back really late at night, be away lots of weekends. I wonder for us, I think I'd rather not be a CEO and have time with family than let it come at this cost. That's my own, as much as I respect him and as much as I learn from his leadership advice, I almost felt like there was something I could have taught him if he'd got this priority right. And you see, it happens for so many of us. We don't have to be CEOs. We just have to let wealth or success become important to us enough that it begins to skew other things. And so what happens on that straight path is we have this priority of family getting skewed because we're putting wealth and success in a position that it was never designed to be up here at the top. Didn't think of that bit. This one I discovered I could print. This one was before I discovered I could print. So this is Rab's artistic skills of writing family. Family's a really good thing. Family's a great thing. And I hope you've had a good experience of family. But like all things that are meaningful, they can still take a really unhealthy place in our life. Family is like this. Our opinion of our family matters so much to us that we feel crushed by their expectations. An example of this, someone was telling me recently about how they were great at playing the violin. Not Amanda. I have to do these disclaimers today. But they weren't the best. And there was like an expectation in their house that they would be a successful violin player. And so every time she looked at the family or every time she looked at the violin, she felt like a failure because pleasing the family was what mattered most to her. And had terrible depression as a result of that. It's when these things take a place of responsibility on us, expectations on us, that suddenly puts everything else out of skew. And so suddenly this person's life felt like it was falling apart because the opinion of their family was so important to them. Another really radical example for us would be when Christians make a stance and it costs them, you know, everything. Their family disowns them because they've become Christians in other countries when they come to faith. And they have to go through the same question of how important is family to me and how important is God to me because it's going to cost me everything. I don't know if I have this as an idol, but I relate to it. One brother I have is a doctor, another brother I have is a lawyer, and then there's me, you know. And I scraped into university and scraped back out as well, to be fair. And sometimes I think you look at your brothers and this thing begins to go into being, I think, oh, man, I'm just not as clever as those guys, you know. Not quite made it as much as them. And there's this ability, there's opportunity for me to take on this burden. You know, and so sometimes for a long time, I used to talk about doing further studies to try and do something like a master's or something just to prove I could do it. Not really sure I could do it, but to prove I could do it. And I realized what was doing it was I was trying to compete with my family and putting them in a position that they're not meant to be in my life. They're meant to be family. That's the good place. That's the right place where they are. But we can often put them too far up in our lives. And finally, the last example, these are all just examples, there's lots of examples that I could make, is romance. And romance can be where, maybe two examples that I could think of when we put romance above the position from meaningful and good into a kind of God position. One is where we're in a relationship where we need the other person's approval. And we so need the other person's approval that the other person in the relationship can no longer bear the weight of just telling the truth. Because if they say anything negative, it'll crush us. And so we end up in this position where the other person feels burdened by the relationship. Like, why would you put me in that position where what I say is remembered for 20 years? If you really want to know the answer to the question you're asking about how am I doing at this or how are things going, then let me tell the truth. Don't put me in this position where you need me. A kind of more basic example, I suppose, is when we so desire romance that we do anything to keep the relationship. And time again, I've sat with people and spoke with people who have done things they didn't want to do, but they did them because they wanted to keep the relationship. And that's totally unacceptable on the other person's part. But also, there's this part where you want to say to the person, you're not losing that much. If that's the kind of guy you're with, if that's the kind of girl you're with, you're not losing that much to step away from that. Because that's not how romance is meant to be. It's meant to have a good and meaningful position, but not where it comes to everything, where we begin to compromise everything else to try and make it something it's not. So I think that helps us think a little clearer. Certainly helps me think a little clearer about what idolatry can look like, that it can take over any part of our lives, really, that we give a position to, where it can begin to force other things out of position. Where things that, if there's kind of five paths going straight, and they begin to skew because we're putting wealth ahead of one, because we're putting romance ahead of the others, because we're putting one into an unhealthy position. These are all modern days idolatries. Now, in fact, and I want to stress, all these things are not bad things. They just can't cope to be in this realm of the ultimate. The only person, the only thing that can cope in this ultimate box is God. And what makes it powerful is that it affects everything else. You see, if I told you, as I did, that idolatry puts everything out of skew, the good news is that God makes everything back into perspective. If those paths are beginning to go askew because we've got idols in our lives, having God in our lives begins to pull these paths back into the straight line that they were designed to operate from. He's the only one who can cope with the weight of being an ultimate, of being everything to you and not disappointing. It's like a swamp that has toxins in it, and the plants suffer because of the toxins. And the bacteria that's meant to grow in the swamp suffers because of the toxins. And the fish suffers. And the animals that drink the water suffers. But once that water is cured, it begins to affect everything. The bacteria grows healthy. The fish go back to being healthy. The plants are healthy again. The animals drinking from the water are healthy again. This one thing being put right puts everything back into place where it is. And so as we put God into this top part of our life, it forces everything into the type of places below where they're meaningful and they're good and they fall, but below where they're not meant to be. And so finally, God takes his rightful place where he belongs. And so God, in this way, let's just explain it, God begins to convict us that we're not spending enough time with our family, or he convicts us that we are putting weights on our family to be successful or perform or whatever that we shouldn't be putting on them. And God says, look at me and the way that I relate the Father to the Son to see the perfect way that family operates. And so God tells us, you know, wealth's a good thing and it's a great thing, but it's not everything. And so you might need to compromise your wealth to spend more time with your family. You might need to compromise your wealth in order to keep your integrity. And then God says, I love you more than you can ever comprehend. And I know exactly what a true relationship looks like. This is romance. And if it doesn't fit in the romance, then it needs to stop or it needs to change. But it's not okay to be so caught up that you're allowed to be treated poorly by another partner. God says it's not good enough. And I've set this example to you in the way that I relate to you, in the way that I relate to others, to show you the way it should be done. Verse 17 tells us, is it a trivial matter for the house of Judah to do the detestable things they are doing here? Must they also fill the land with violence and continually provoke me to anger? As God lost his rightful place in Israel, so did the commands of God. God always puts throughout his laws to Israel, I need to look after the most vulnerable of society, the foreigners and the widows and the orphans. And when they began to see that as the worship of God left, so did the character of God. And so God describes this violence that's coming into the land from those people. And that's because when God's not in his rightful place, everything else falls out of place as well. The great tragedy for us too as believers is that we begin to move away from God. We begin to say to ourselves, as he did in verse 12, the Lord does not see us. The Lord has forsaken the land. I think in this way it's a self-fulfilling prophecy that as we move away from God, we begin to ask the question, God, where are you? Remember, those people came to Ezekiel and said, has God abandoned us? And God's response is really, I haven't abandoned you, you've abandoned me. But as we abandon God, it feels like we're further and further away from God. And then we begin this question, God, where are you? And he's saying, I'm here, I've been here the whole time. Just come back to me. Suddenly we find ourselves compromising positions because God's no longer most important to us. We find at work that we lie to protect mistakes we made because we feel that being seen as successful at work is more important than our integrity to God. We find ourselves racked up with debt because we want to live in the image of being wealthy despite the fact we don't have the money to spend. We find ourselves in unhealthy relationships but tolerate being treated poorly because of those little moments when we're told that we're special, even though their behavior shows they think nothing of us. The good news is that God does see us. And knowing all that we have done, all that we will do, he still came into this world for us. He came as the Lord. He bought us at a price, and he came that we might realize what awaits us living with him in the ultimate. And everything else is meaningful, but not necessary. God shows his holiness to us, his purity, but we find we would rather honor him in our life than look good at work. We truly know we've got God in the right place when we take a hit for the sake of it. There's an interesting business discussion that says you'll finally sold to your values when you'll pay the price to live up to those values. And so the example they give is an airline company. And one of their values is always to be humorous, to have good fun. And so the guy makes a really fun kind of mock with the your exits are here and the safety talk you get. And some lady, obviously petrified of flying, wrote in and said, this is ridiculous. You shouldn't be joking about this kind of stuff. And the CEO wrote back and said, we'll miss you. And that's all he said on the card. And he was willing to lose the customers for the sake of having humor as the very core of what this company was about. And I think it's the same for us, not the we'll miss you bit, but the fact that when we're willing to pay the price just to honor God in our life, then suddenly we find that God is higher in our life. He's taken that priority that he needs to. So sometimes we confess the things that we've done that make us look not so good. We might miss out on a bonus or a promotion, or we confess the things in relationships that we've done wrong instead of keeping them secret. And we do it because we want to have integrity before God, no matter what the cost is, no matter what they end up costing us as a result, because God's more important to us. We find that we're satisfied not in belonging but in God. And so we find that not only do we not need to spend the money we don't have, but we live on even less in order to give away more. We delight in using God's money to build God's kingdom, not our own. John Piper says it quite nicely when he says, God is most glorified when we're most satisfied in him. God is most glorified when we're most satisfied in him. We find that we have a perfect example of Christ in a healthy relationship. A love that's not abusive and a security that no matter what we do, God will never, ever, ever walk out on us. We don't need to do things to please him. And we can let go of those expectancies or him expecting anything less of us. I mean, just remember the reality that despite everything that's going on in Ezekiel 8, God is still speaking to Ezekiel. So the final point I want to make to you is about God's character and this wonderful reality of his character. God is a jealous God. He describes the idols in verse 3 as an idol of jealousy. This is a negative word typically when we use it, but God wants all of us. He doesn't want a little of us. God gave everything he had to get us, and he isn't interested in getting one day a week or a percentage. He wants all of us. Now, I want you to understand that God is self-sufficient. He doesn't need us. He was complete on his own, and he didn't need to create us. And this is important because God is not jealous because he needs attention, like a dog does tricks to try and get a treat from us or more of our attention when we clap him and say, well done. He's perfectly able to be all he is, and he's totally unchanged with or without your love. But despite not needing us, he wanted us. He chose to create us. And in not needing our love that neither adds nor removes anything from us, he still loved us enough to die on the cross for us. God wasn't compelled to do it. He wanted to do it. Just to show how much he wants what's best for you. Just to show how much he loves you. Just to show how much he wants to be intimate with you. Doesn't want to be like a friend. Doesn't want to be like your pal. He wants to be the relationship of a creator and the created. And that's why God is jealous for us. He isn't okay with just being known. He isn't okay with just being a friend. He wants to be your everything. And so when he finally becomes everything, as we were created to make him, everything else begins to fall into place along with it as well. Let's pray together. Lord, I thank you that you are self-sufficient. I thank you, Lord, that in the Trinity, you had all the fellowship that you need and continue to today. And yet, Lord, you looked upon us and you saw coming into the world as a man, humbling yourself, though the Creator becoming created, though the High King of Kings and Lord of Lords becoming a servant, just so that we could have life and life to the fullest. Not because it added anything to you, but just to glorify your name in saving us. Lord, in this difficult subject of idolatry, I just pray that you would reveal to us this week there are areas in our lives that we're holding back from you. And Lord, would you reveal to us the pain of putting things in these ultimate positions? Lord, if it's wealth or if it's romance or if it's family or whatever it be, Lord, I pray that your perspective would just straighten that path. That we would be able to live more happily, more fully, but more importantly, Lord, we'd be able to live in you and securely with you as our creator and our salvation. We ask these things in your holy and your precious name. Amen.